You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Time for your view from the C-suite here on Classic Business, bringing you closer to South Africa's business and political economy leaders. What makes him tick? What keeps him up at night and keeps him going through this pandemic? My next guest has his hands full with issues around COVID and climate change and the just energy transition as CEO of Anglo American Coal South Africa, July Ndlovu. Welcome to The View, July.
Thank you, Michael, for inviting me.
Now, you graduated in engineering and business leadership from the universities of Zimbabwe and South Africa, respectively, and you completed a senior executive program with Columbia Business School. But I want to take you back to your upbringing. Where in Zimbabwe did you grow up?
If you rattle qualifications like that, that sounds a lot more impressive. I guess it sounds like somebody else. So let's go back to the beginning of where I was born. I was born in a small village in the middle of the country, just outside the mining town of Shurugwe. Actually born at a mission school, a Methodist mission. So I grew up in those rural areas, and I guess my upbringing, everything that I've learned, everything that I've become, was shaped by that very early upbringing in the rural areas.
And were there hard hats in the family growing up in a rural area near local mining in Zim? How did you actually get involved in mining in particular?
My involvement in mining is an accident, actually. But yes, you're right. My father was a miner, but he retired very early on when I was about, 4 or 5. A very interesting and sad story that he got injured in the mining industry. And when he recovered and went back, he really couldn't carry on, so he was retired as a result of that. I guess one of the things that I then took as a result is that when I got to work, the issues of safety were quite important to me, simply because my father suffered the indignity, if you like, of getting injured whilst he was just trying to provide for his family.
We know it is so, such a big issue in the South African mining industry now in particular. Whenever you attend any results announcement, mining companies start with their safety records first. On that point, before we skip along into the rest of your career, what sort of progress do you think we've made as an industry in South Africa in this aim of net zero harm from mining?
We've made a massive progress. If you go back 10 years and you look at the number of people who are dying in our mines and you look at where we are today, I accept that every death that we've got is one too many, but clearly the progress was made. I remember when I joined Anglo Platinum way back in 2000, I think we were having something like between 30 and 40 fatalities every year. To think that last year they went a full year without a single fatality in itself is testimony of the progress that the mining industry has done. And quite frankly, our understanding of what it takes to manage and prevent fatalities in the mines has also progressed to move away from merely chasing injuries to preventing deaths in all its forms, including workplace health-related deaths. And I think the progress we've made is phenomenal.
Now, you became an accidental miner, you say. What's that story?
Having grown up in poverty, abject poverty, you know, one of those where if you come to think of it, a miner who retired in the 60s in Rhodesia, you wouldn't have retired with anything. If they gave you a couple of roof sheets to go and build a house, you were lucky. Oh. Education was not something that I thought would happen, but that was my father's ambition and dream for me. So when I went to school, really it was hard. In fact, in some instances, I actually had to work for my own education. When I then went to high school, I was lucky, blessed. I had an average mind, got good results, and I ended up applying for an Anglo scholarship. My dream was to become a doctor, simply informed by my desire to make a difference in the community. But when I applied for my scholarship, the old man who spoke to us, who was the technical director of Anglo, really made engineering sound like, you know, is the best thing that you can ever do. If you want to make a big difference, the thing you must do is go and mine these metals that can change people's lives across the globe. And I just thought, wow, this is where I want to be. And that was the last, my dream of becoming a doctor. and out of the window it went.
Now, you were appointed the CEO of Coal South Africa in September of 2016. Prior to that, you've held the position of Executive Head of Processing at Anglo-American Platinum, as you mentioned. You were also employed by Anglo subsidiaries in Zimbabwe, where you held several senior managerial positions. So, steeped in the lore of 44 Main Street, as they call it, my former mentor, David Gleeson, worked for quite some time as the personal assistant for Gavin Reilly when he was CEO of Anglo. And there was a particular culture around Anglo-American. How has that Anglo culture shaped who you are as a business leader today?
I guess the best way to tell you that how that shaped me is to give you context. One of my values, one of my principles is really just wanting to make a difference wherever I am. And maybe it's actually the way I was brought up too. And what happened when I got a scholarship, what they used to do in Anglo, they would bring you to South Africa to meet with the doyens of this big company. And one of the people we met was, say, Eric Oppenheimer, the son of the founder. And in the conversations, he said something that has stayed with me a long time ago. And actually, it came out of the fact that, you know, you can imagine when you're a youngster and you're coming into the hallowed halls of 44 Main Street, and you get served a sumptuous meal. One of the things I asked was, actually, who pays for those meals? And he said, as a youngster, and he said, nobody actually pays for them, because my father said, these people who work for us are like a family. And then he told us about all the things that they were doing, about the desire to make a difference, about the things they were doing in the communities, and offering scholarships was one of those things that they were doing to make a difference, just give hope to young people who ordinarily wouldn't have any hope. And you can imagine what that did to me. I just felt at that point in time, I was joining an organization which had a purpose far bigger than just making profit. And of course, for a young mind, just being told that you're giving hope to young people was a big thing for me. And I guess that is one of the reasons why I've stayed with this company for a long, long time. Because I've always found that our values, our purpose resonates with who I am as a person.
It certainly has been that Anglo is amongst mining companies best of breed. And it's an important point to stress at a time like this. Because we're having these conversations around climate change, around the just transition, around the future of coal. And we certainly understand that our energy system is still quite heavily reliant on coal. But from that perspective, and considering that a firm like Anglo is the best of South African mining in so many ways, should Anglo and Anglo Coal be a coordinating force for good in this just energy transition? Because government doesn't seem to believe that it's going to happen. If you look at the pace of the transition so far, if you listen to what the mines minister, Gwede Mantashe, has been saying, and it does leave us all open to even greater risks. Shouldn't the large majors who've benefited from coal in South Africa for many decades be leading this process, July?
Michael, I've never doubted that Anglo is a force for good, and will always be a force for good, that when they say, we do not own the assets in the ground, we operate for the good of the people and nations in which we operate, they actually mean it. And I've lived that. So the question you're asking about should Anglo be an agent, a force for the good in terms of the just transition, I think one has to recognize what we mean by the just transition. Because quite often, very simplistically, people tend to think of the just transition as just moving from coal to clean energy. And that debate loses the fact that actually these mines do far more good where we operate. They contribute so much more than just merely producing coal. And you know, you probably know this, that the relationship between mines and the communities go beyond just the product that we produce. In a lot of instances, mines do provide the infrastructure, Could that be roads? Could that be clinics? Could that be schools? In fact, in a lot of instances, businesses in and around those communities are entirely dependent on the mining activities within which we operate. Therefore, when we think about the just transition, we should think not just about mitigating the impact of climate change, but the impact on the communities, on the employees, on the governments of the countries in which we operate. And how we do that requires us to do that in a very responsible and considered way. And I think that's the journey that we as Anglo have been on. For instance, what we did with Eskom Tag Mine demonstrates that very clearly, that what we decided to do was to exit those mines, but make sure that those mines end up in the hands of a responsible operator, somebody who has got the capital and the know-how to be able to continue to grow those mines and provide jobs, provide livelihoods to the communities that we operate in. Of course, it's a fact that climate change is real, and therefore we need to transition from the fossil fuels towards greener, cleaner technologies. And we've got to be part of that, whether that is in terms of cleaner coal technologies, or actually, as Anglo has very clearly stated, the metals of the future, such as copper, such as platinum, you've got to take all of them together if you think about a mining company like ourselves becoming a force for good. And I think Anglo's commitment to that has been exemplary.
July, I think while you said that, and I want to understand from your perspective what good looks like, and one risk with coal markets as they are is that the large diversified miners like Anglo sell on their assets to smaller pure coal players who often lack the capacity to responsibly manage closure, either environmentally or socially, in terms of transition planning around mines or in mining regions. As you mentioned, it's not just about extracting coal. It's about the communities. It's about the workers in Mpumalanga. Would the responsible thing to do in terms of global climate change challenges and commitments not be to commit to a timeline for the phase out of coal mining and closure of your mines yourself, rather than pushing that risk onto smaller players or South Africa?
That's a good question, and that's a polarity that we always have to deal with and do the right trade-off. Because if you think of a global diversified miner, the downside of continuing to hold onto those assets as well is that if the coal mine can no longer attract the necessary capital to continue to invest in the future and do all these good things that you're describing. Because cleaning the environment, making sure that we manage the environment responsibly, making sure that we manage water and water pollution, air pollution, is as important. But sometimes it requires capital. And sometimes an organization has got to get to that point where they say, if we look at our portfolio in its totality, is it better for these assets to be in the hands of somebody else who can actually allocate capital to these assets responsibly? The trick then, Michael, is not just exiting, as you rightly pointed out, is exiting into the hands of a person or persons who are actually able to allocate the capital required to run this business responsibly for the benefit of the communities, for the benefit of the employees and the country. So the choice of how you exit becomes quite important. And that's why we as Anglo always, although we stated that, you know, we'll be out of this in 2 to 3 years, we actually said we'll go through a very rigorous process to determine how to do that, so that we do this responsibly.
We know there are rehab funds associated with these mines. Do those then get transferred to the new owners to at least ensure that they have access to sufficient capital when it comes to rehabilitation?
Absolutely, because remember, the rehab funds are tied to the mining right. So those would go with the mines when you transfer them. So that is not something that you'd keep, for instance, in the hands of Anglo should they dispose of those assets.
Now, what we are seeing in coal markets at the moment is depressed prices for a number of reasons. And obviously with that brings a contextual risk that is in the here and now. Very often we talk about the just transition, but that seems to be a little bit more into the future. The very real issues now around the prices now for exports, I think around $50 for high grade. I'm sure they will rebound, but long term, this has all sorts of risks. For Transnet, for social and labour plans, etc. How are you thinking about managing that? And how are you thinking about managing low prices and considering that this may create risks and pressure in places like Mpumalanga, especially in terms of funding social and labour plans and community projects?
COVID and the coal markets have been a real challenge, but I suspect it's not just a challenge for the coal markets. This dislocation is not something that any of us have seen before. But I think what we all have realized is the importance of coal in the multiple markets. Even in the middle of the COVID, there is still some residual demand, simply because actually there is still energy demand. The way to cope with this challenge actually starts long before a black swan event like this. By setting your business to be robust, to be efficient, to be productive, there is no substitute to having your assets in the lower cost of the of in the lower half of the cost curve, which is what we've worked very hard on to make sure that we've got some of the most productive mines. So in that instance, Michael, we're quite lucky. But we've also been very thoughtful right from the beginning when this challenge was staring us in the face in the beginning of this year. One of the things we had to think very hard about is this challenge between, should we get to a stage where we have to close? Do we close all the mines? Or we are actually able to find a pathway where we can protect our employees, but actually keep the mines running in some shape or form, so that in fact we can protect the livelihoods. And I think we have been able to find an approach as Anglo, and as the mining industry, to be able to not only protect our employees from the mitigations we put to prevent infections and respond to those infections, but also to protect their livelihoods by keeping the mines running. I think doing that, he has been able to mitigate very substantially the downside associated with the dislocations we've seen. And of course, demand has been a big issue. But we're working through that as best as we can.
When you look at the future and you try and envisage an Mpumalanga post-coal, what does that future look like? And how can it be achieved in a way that is just for the communities and workers in that area and that region that have established their lives, their entire way of lives around a particular commodity? And what role do you see in achieving that future?
So what you're asking me is to look long, much further than probably a natural eye can see or conceive. So what would the Witbank coal basin look like after all the coal is finished? We have been working on an idea, and we call it the Green Engine. What we've been thinking about is what industries could be self-sustaining given the real estate infrastructure we've got in Mpumalanga. And some of those ideas we are piloting include things like putting up solar farms, beginning to use the land that we've mined for agriculture, intensive agriculture, not just, you know, natural agriculture, creating network industries associated with some of the effects of mining, like water cleaning, and then using that water to feed the communities, given that this is water-scarce country. So what we have been doing is really developing a concept that we are busy piloting as an industry of this symbiotic industries that can be self-sustaining long after mining. And my view, quite frankly, Mike, is that if we direct our social labor spend towards some of these nascent ideas, it is possible to create alternative forms of livelihood after mining in that coal basin.
Very interesting when you look at the land issue. Have you assessed the value of your coal mining land if it were rehabilitated whatever coal land you have on your balance sheets? And certainly in the context of the land reform question, it does tend to offer some sort of opportunities. And as you say, there are opportunities for agricultural land reform. And with the infrastructure already in place to get that produce to market as well, what is the value of that land?
Quite honestly, don't put ideas in the heads of politicians, because I haven't done that work. But what I do know, however, the reason why this agricultural concept looks attractive to me, certainly at a concept level, is that, you know, food demand is always going to be there. And we have got land today. And we know, as the mining industry, how to rehabilitate that land. And some of the concepts we have been playing with is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, we've been putting these bugs that can convert subsoil to actually arable soil. And if you go and see it, you can't help but actually have your mind blown. And we think we can convert most of the land that we have actually disturbed into arable land. If not arable land, certainly we can put cattle on it. And what is that, the value of that land? I have no idea at this point in time. All I know, it will be valuable.
Absolutely, and offers solutions that we so desperately need in South Africa. Just as we reach the end of our time, July, and the state of the country is obviously front and center for everyone right now. Thanks to COVID-19, the government's decision to go into hard lockdown, I think everyone supported that in the initial stages. And we're seeing now here in South Africa and all around the world how difficult it is to restart economies following a pandemic of this nature. And no one had the rule book or the playbook in the beginning. But what we have seen is economic devastation. What would you like to see in terms of leadership from the government side and particularly from the ministry side to ensure that we can get the best out of our mining sector to help catalyze growth as we look to rebuild post-COVID-19?
Michael, firstly, I have to give credit to Minister Matashe. He has been absolutely phenomenal throughout the difficulties we've had. His willingness to collaborate, his willingness to listen, his willingness to take tough decisions that sometimes put him at odds with the general and popular opinion, which in my view, actually given this debate about life, saving lives and livelihoods, has turned out to be right. All I can ask for is that we need to see more of that leadership. Secondly, I think what we have gone through, a once-in-a-lifetime experience, has offered some real lessons for us as a country. If you think about where we started in your right, how all of us trusted our government and listened and supported everything that they said we needed to do. And it's amazing to see how all of us were willing to sacrifice our freedoms for a higher goal. And I think if our government, our leadership, is able to galvanize popular opinion and our willingness as a people to sacrifice, to actually begin to create a new reality for us as a country that can create new opportunities, that mining actually can play a significant role, given that essentially we are a resource-rich country. This country could create a very different inclusive economy coming out of a very sad chapter that every single person in this country has gone through. This is not a time where we can afford to lose that opportunity. I've seen partnerships and collaboration coming to life so quickly, a willingness for us to put aside our differences and work for the common good. Some of the things we've been able to do in the province, collaborating with local government, collaborating with provincial government, collaborating as an industry, and even at a national level, the things that we've been able to do, just set a foundation that if we can continue with that energy and focus, we actually can turn around this economy far quicker than any of us have imagined just yet.
Well, on that note, July, one certainly hopes that we can build on those foundations and look to grow the economy with these new partnerships that have been forged through a crisis. As Bobby Godsell loved to say, South Africa and South Africans had a penchant for walking all the way over to the edge of the abyss and looking over, but then pulling themselves back right at the 11th hour. And it certainly does have the feeling, certainly if you look at our fiscal situation and the supplementary budget picture that was painted by the finance minister last week, that we are staring over the abyss. And let's hope that we can use these new partnerships to pull ourselves back. Thank you very much for your time, for sharing your personal leadership journey with us, and also your thoughts into the role that Anglo-American and Anglo-American Coal can play in a just transition. Take care.